So what if I told you the single best framework for preventing like a million-dollar IT disaster was actually hiding inside a boring local SEO marketing document for Orange County?
I mean, I would probably say you are crazy, but it's actually true.
Really? It's wild. Welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. We are opening a literal Trojan horse from the year 2026 today.
Yeah, it's a fascinating document.
On the outside, our source material is titled Orange County 2026 Local SEO Landing Page Strategic Checklist, which, you know, sounds like something an intern might just skim on their lunch break.
Exactly. It sounds so niche and harmless.
But once you actually look at the mechanics inside this document, you realize it is not a simple marketing cheat sheet at all. It's this hardcore executive level playbook for evaluating risk, managing vendors, and making these massive technology decisions.
It's an incredibly deceptive piece of source material. And, you know, to understand its actual value, you really have to look at the business landscape it was written for in 2026.
Right, because things were shifting a lot then.
Oh, massively. Companies are operating under these immense competing pressures. Budgets are heavily constrained. But at the same time, security expectations from clients and regulators are just completely unforgiving.
So the stakes are way higher.
Exactly. Like a data breach or a failed rollout isn't just an IT headache anymore. You know, it is an existential threat to the business.
Wow. Yeah, that changes the dynamic.
Right. Because of that, leadership teams are demanding real empirical evidence before they sign off on literally any new initiative. The era of buying a software platform just because the sales rep had a slick slide deck, that's fundamentally over.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the mission for our deep dive today is to extract this hidden decision-making architecture.
Yeah, we really want to pull out the core principles.
We're going to decode the blueprint inside this so-called SEO checklist so you can actually apply it to your own work, whether you are, you know, leading massive server migration or just trying to hire a local marketing agency.
Right, because this framework is designed to keep you from walking into an expensive operational trap, no matter the industry.
So where do we start?
Well, the first step in avoiding those traps is understanding the psychology of the search itself. Like, why does a team suddenly decide they need a new SEO landing page checklist or, you know, a new piece of software?
It's feeling stuck, maybe.
Sort of. The text points out that when a team goes searching for a new tool, they're usually trying to medicate a deeper operational symptom. They're feeling this gap in their organization.
So wait, the search for a tool is really just kind of a cry for help about broken process?
In almost every single case, yeah. The gap rarely has anything to do with search engine optimization. It usually stems from a much more systemic friction.
Like what kind of friction?
Well, they're feeling the pain of unclear internal ownership, right? Where no one actually knows who has the authority to update a web page. Or maybe they're dealing with a vendor relationship that has just slowly devolved over the years.
Relying on blind trust instead of actual metrics.
Exactly. They know their daily operations feel sluggish and risky, so they just assume a new piece of software or a new checklist will act as a silver bullet.
I mean, buying a localized SEO tool before defining that operational gap, it's like buying a bunch of expensive power tools before you even have a blueprint for the house.
That's a perfect way to put it.
You're just kind of numbing the symptom.
Mm-hmm.
Say, a slow customer acquisition rate while you continue to walk on a completely shattered internal process.
And the new tool actually allows you to do more long-term damage because you just don't feel the pain right away.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
And that is the exact mechanism that leads to the text's first major warning, which is do not take a tool-first approach.
Right.
The framework insists that before you look at any systems, before you evaluate vendors, and before you even discuss data access, leadership has to isolate and define the specific business outcome they want to achieve.
But wait, I have to push back on this a little bit. Isn't defining the exact business outcome incredibly difficult when you don't even know what the technology is capable of yet?
It can be, yeah.
Like if I'm evaluating a new AI tool or automation platform and I'm flying blind on the tool's ceiling, how am I supposed to write a rigid success metric for it before I even test it?
I get that. It feels really restrictive. But the text requires the sequence to prevent a very specific psychological trap.
Okay, what trap?
If you purchase the tool first just to see what it can do, right? And you haven't locked in the success metric beforehand, human nature just takes over.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. The team will simply invent a definition of success after the fact to justify the money they just spent.
Oh, the retroactive victory. It's
Exactly.
like, well, the software didn't increase our sales conversion rate like we hoped,
Yeah.
but, you know, user time on page is up by 2%, so the rollout was a massive success.
It happens constantly. You retrofit the narrative.
Yeah.
But by forcing the team to define the metric first, whether that's like a 20% reduction in system downtime or a specific number of resolved security findings, you anchor the entire initiative in reality.
Right, the tool has to serve the metric, not the other way around.
Exactly.
But, you know, even a perfectly defined metric doesn't manage itself. You can write reduce downtime by 20% on a whiteboard all day, but unless human beings are actually driving that outcome, it's just wishful thinking.
Which brings us directly to the source material's absolute obsession with internal ownership.
Yeah, let's talk about that because the text introduces these four foundational questions that just echo throughout the whole thing like a mantra.
They really do. And these aren't just passing thoughts. They are a gauntlet that any new initiative has to survive.
Right. Question one, what evidence supports the recommendation? Question two, who owns the outcome after launch? Question three, what risks must be handled before implementation? And question four, how will success be measured after 30, 60, and 90 days?
And notice how it keeps demanding we ask who owns the outcome.
Yeah, it feels almost paranoid about ownership. Why
Yeah.
is it so terrified of like a shared team goal?
Because in corporate structures, a shared goal often means shared negligence.
Oh, that's so true.
Right. If everyone owns the outcome, no one is actually accountable for the failure. So to enforce this, the document mandates four distinct internal roles for any project.
Okay, what are they?
First, you have the executive sponsor, whose job is solely to secure the budget and remove bureaucratic blockers.
Makes sense.
Then you have the business owner, who defines the overarching outcomes. Third is the technical owner, who validates the actual feasibility of the project.
Okay, and the fourth.
And finally, you have the operational reviewer. They confirm the new system won't just destroy the day-to-day workflow of the frontline staff.
You know, the friction between those roles is kind of fascinating.
It's totally intentional.
Right, because the business owner's primary motivation is just the outcome. They just want lead generation to spike. But the technical owner's motivation is stability.
Exactly.
They know the shiny new marketing tool doesn't integrate with the legacy CRM without creating like a massive security vulnerability.
And if you don't have both roles explicitly fighting for their priorities, one just steamrolls the other. The friction is the feature, not a bug.
Right. It prevents marketing from buying software that IT literally cannot support.
Exactly.
Let's apply this to a smaller scale, though. In a massive enterprise, sure, you have four distinct executives arguing in a boardroom.
Sure.
But in a startup or even a mid-sized company, aren't these four roles usually just one highly caffeinated, overworked person wearing every single hat?
They are. And the source material addresses that reality directly. In a smaller organization, these roles absolutely overlap.
Okay.
But the text argues that the distinct responsibilities must remain completely compartmentalized in your mind. You have to know which hat you're wearing at any given moment.
So you have to ask yourself, am I evaluating this as the visionary sponsor right now, or as the operational reviewer who actually has to use this clunky software on a Tuesday afternoon?
Precisely. If a single founder blurs those responsibilities together, they will inevitably sacrifice operational reality for visionary excitement.
That is such a good point. But even if you have those internal roles perfectly aligned, you still have a massive blind spot. You don't control the vendor.
Right. You don't.
So how does a well-structured internal team force an external vendor to actually play by their rules?
Well, that is where the 2026 scorecard criteria become incredibly rigid. The document outlines exactly how to vet the outside world.
Right. It talks about evaluating capability, security, and implementation quality.
Naturally. But the two metrics that carry the absolute most weight are cost transparency and exit readiness.
Okay, exit readiness. I really want to spend a minute here because this isn't just a safety net. It feels like you are evaluating a vendor based on how easily you can fire them.
You basically are.
It's like demanding a prenuptial agreement on the first date. You're sitting across the table saying, "I'm excited to work with you, but before we start, I need you to document exactly how I can extract all my data and leave you."
I mean, it's actually more severe than a prenup. A prenup just divides existing assets. This framework demands that the vendor actively build the exact escape hatch you will use to leave them, and they have to do it before the project even begins.
Wow.
Yeah, you demand code ownership, data export formats, and administrative handoff steps up front. And there's a deeper mechanical reason for this too. It's a literal test of their technical competence.
Wait, how so?
Think about it. If a vendor says, oh, we'll figure out data migration later, it usually means their system architecture is so messy or proprietary that they don't actually know how to extract your data cleanly.
Oh, wow. I never thought about it like that.
Right. A vendor's willingness and ability to map out an exit strategy proves they have a disciplined, structured technical environment.
What's also fascinating is the section on warning signs during this vetting process. The text lists these specific red flags to watch for.
Yeah, it's a great list.
Vague scope is an obvious one. But another major one is the lack of a rollback plan. Why do vendors actively try to hide the fact that they don't have a rollback plan?
Because it forces them to admit their implementation might irreversibly overwrite your legacy data.
Yikes.
Exactly. If a vendor cannot guarantee that they can revert your systems back to their original state, if the new tool crashes on day one, the risk profile of the entire project just skyrockets.
Right. And another red flag is pricing that conveniently hides maintenance. But the absolute biggest warning sign to me, if a vendor cannot clearly explain how the work will be measured and verified in the first 90 days, the project simply isn't ready.
Period.
Yeah.
What's fascinating here is how the framework flips the traditional power dynamic.
Yeah, definitely.
Historically, software vendors and marketing agencies kind of dictated the terms, operating in a bit of a black box. This playbook insists the buyer must seize total control of the engagement before signing the contract.
Okay, so let's say the vendor passes the scorecard. The escape hatch is built, the metrics are set. Now the actual rollout begins.
This is where it gets tricky.
Yeah, because this is traditionally where the friction of reality hits the pristine project plan and everything derails.
Right, because most rollouts lack a phased mechanical structure. But the text mandates a rigid 90-day success plan to control this friction.
How does that break down?
So days 1 through 30 are purely diagnostic. You're just clarifying the current state and identifying priority gaps.
Okay.
Days 31 through 60 are for piloting the highest value improvement. And note that it is just a pilot, not a global launch.
Yeah.
Then days 61 through 90 are exclusively for reviewing the results of that pilot, documenting the lessons, and deciding if the tool should be expanded or scrapped entirely.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. I look at this 90-day plan, and the source specifically carves out a discovery phase that can take 1 to 3 weeks.
Yes, the auditing and planning phase.
Right. But we are talking about the business landscape of 2026. Taking 3 weeks just to think about a landing page or an SEO plan feels kind of glacial. Shouldn't teams be executing immediately?
I mean, it seems counterintuitive to slow down when the market is moving that fast. But the source provides crucial context here by mentioning the involvement of consulting firms like Technegian.
Okay, how do they fit in?
Firms like this step in before decisions are finalized to scope the work meticulously.
So the discovery phase isn't just about thinking, it's about boundary setting.
Exactly. Doing a 1 to 3 week discovery prevents the project from mutating into an open-ended initiative.
Which is how projects go wildly over budget.
Right. Slowing down to scope the work creates a practical checkpoint for leadership. You invest a fraction of the budget up front to validate requirements, which means a leadership team doesn't have to wait 12 months and burn $500,000 to figure out if the tool actually works.
It's the ultimate time saver. You slow down to speed up.
Exactly.
And speaking of budgets, the text offers a really harsh reality check here. It states point blank that the lowest initial estimate is rarely the lowest total cost.
Oh, absolutely.
Because companies consistently strip out the invisible line items to make the budget look better on paper.
They cut the things that don't produce immediate visible features. They slash the budget for QA testing, they minimize employee training, and they skip deep security reviews.
And even on a localized marketing project, like an SEO landing page, you are still dealing with credentials and customer information.
Exactly. Security is no longer an isolated IT function. It's embedded in every single technology decision.
And if you rush that process, you hit the classic rollout mistakes. Teams skip user acceptance testing. They over-customize a tool before validating the core process.
Yes.
But the most dangerous habit mentioned, and I see this everywhere, is leaving the old workflows running right alongside the new system.
The mechanism of shadow IT and workflow paralysis.
Yeah.
Middle management is often terrified that the new system will fail. So as a backup, they force their frontline staff to do double data entry.
It's the worst. They have to enter the client's info into the shiny new platform and then log it into the old legacy spreadsheet just in case.
Which instantly crushes morale, doubles the workload, and completely destroys the ROI of the new tool.
The staff ends up hating the new system simply because it just represents more work.
Precisely. Which is why the operational reviewer we discussed earlier is so vital. Their job is to ensure the old workflow is forcefully retired once the pilot proves successful.
All right, so the 90 days are up, the pilot was a success, the old workflow is burned to the ground.
Sounds perfect.
So they're finally done, right?
Not quite. There is one final non-negotiable step that ensures everything you just built doesn't collapse the moment the team changes.
Right. The ultimate safeguard. Documentation.
Yes.
And the source text is absolutely ruthless about this.
Yeah.
You cannot postpone documentation until the end of the project.
No, you can't.
It's like you don't build a skyscraper and then try to draw the architectural blueprints from memory once the tenants move in.
That's exactly it. If we connect this to the bigger picture, documentation is the foundation of institutional resilience. It's the literal translation of logic from a human brain into institutional memory. The framework specifies exactly what must be recorded.
Decision notes, workflow diagrams, access ownership.
Change history, all of it.
The decision notes are the most critical part to me. It's not just documenting what was built, but why it was built that way.
Yes, the context.
Documentation is essentially a time capsule. You're leaving notes for future teams so they don't look at a system 2 years from now and scream, why on earth did they configure the database this way?
Exactly. You're giving them the context of the constraints you were operating under. And, you know, returning to our evaluation of external partners, thorough documentation is the clearest signal of a vendor's actual discipline.
How so?
Well, if an agency or a software provider is willing to meticulously document their architecture and hand you the keys, it proves they stand behind the stability of their work and they respect that exit readiness we talked about earlier.
So what does this all mean for you listening? We started this deep dive looking at a document that presented itself as a somewhat dry, you know, Orange County local SEO checklist.
Right.
But by unpacking the mechanisms inside it, we uncovered a universal bulletproof architecture for making sound business decisions.
It really is a phenomenal mental model. And the true value of this framework, like demanding empirical evidence, enforcing friction between internal roles, securing the exit hatch, is that it scales flawlessly.
Yeah, completely.
Yes, you can use it to hire a local SEO vendor, but you can apply these exact same rules of engagement to massive custom software development or complex corporate cloud migrations.
The methodology doesn't change just because the price tag gets bigger.
Exactly. It fundamentally changes how you perceive operational risk. You stop looking for silver bullet tools and you start looking at the mechanics of your own internal processes.
Which actually brings me to a final thought I want to leave you with. The source material stresses the vital importance of exit readiness and rigorous documentation so that a company isn't paralyzed if a vendor or a key employee suddenly departs.
Right.
Think about your own day-to-day operations right now. Ask yourself this. If you were to suddenly leave your current role tomorrow, is your own work documented well enough to pass the exit readiness test?
That's a tough question.
Or have you accidentally created a workflow that traps your team into relying entirely on your personal memory and expertise? Because if you are the only person holding the map, that isn't job security. It is a massive operational vulnerability for your organization.
That's powerful.
Take a page from the 2026 playbook. Start documenting your why and build a blueprint your whole team can actually use. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.